This is elections interview number 4 with Mrs. Augustina Akumani at the National Commission for Civic Education in Accra, Ghana. It is August 13th, and the interviewer is Ashley McCants. Thank you very much for agreeing to participate in this interview.
Yes.
I like to begin these conversations by learning a little more about a person's personal background.
Okay.
So can you describe the position you hold here at the National Commission for Civic Education and what the goals are in your position?
At the moment, I am the deputy chairman responsible for programs. And the commission is made up of a management team. There's a chairman who enjoys the same rights as a court of appeal judge. Then there are 2 deputies who also enjoy the same conditions of service as high court judges, and 4 ordinary members of the commission who are part-timers, so they don't work here. But the day-to-day administration of the commission is managed by the chairman and the 2 deputy chairmen, plus the management team, which is made up of the directors at the head office level, at the regional level, and the district level.
And what are your specific responsibilities?
The commission members, the team of 7, we develop the policies for the running of the commission. We employ the staff, and we do the day-to-day management of the whole commission. We meet as a board once every month. That is what the law says. But ordinarily, we do everyday administration, like managing the finances that the government have set to us, doing education in the villages, the towns, and everywhere.
Can you tell me more about the positions you held before you came to this?
Oh, yes. I went to the University of Ghana, and I finished a long time ago, 1972. And I read for a degree in English literature. Then after that, I went to Institute of Public Administration. We call it GIMPA. Ghana Institute of Management and Public Administration, where I did a diploma in management. And I joined the Ghana Civil Service as an administrative officer, class 4, which is the lowest class in the senior officer grade. And I rose through the ranks to the second in command of the ministry, which was like assistant deputy director. Or at that time, we used to call it principal assistant secretary. So I worked for 12 years in that capacity. Then I left because my husband went to England. So I left and went to Britain, where they, I joined the local government system there. And I worked for 20 years in 5 London boroughs as a principal committee administrator. After that stint of years in Britain, I thought I've had enough. And by that time, Ghana has just moved into constitutional rule from 1992. In 2000, this government came into power, and I went to the embassy to see the ambassador in London at that time was my mate at University of Ghana. So when he saw me, he said, "Tina, what are you doing here? The country needs you." So since then, I started, "No, I better go home." But I have my husband and 3 children in England. And I was torn between, shall I go? And I had a very good job because, I mean, a principal officer, I was getting almost £2,000 a month. And I was coming here to get £400. So I was really torn between my country and, you know, my economic comfort. But at the end of the day, the country won. So I came in August 2003, and I went to the castle to see the chief of staff, and then I was appointed to this job. This job is not a political appointment, but it's appointed you are appointed by the president in consultation with the Council of State. So you must be somebody who is experienced and can run an organization and must have a clean background and must be an outstanding character. So I got here the past 4 years, and so far so good. I've enjoyed it and I'm happy to be here.
Can you describe how this commission was established?
Yes. This commission was established by an act of parliament in 1993. It was actually signed on 7th of July, 1993. This National Commission for Civic Education was set up as one of the last independent commissions set up because they're those who drafted the constitution. They looked at the history of Ghana. And they realized that from the time of independence, 1957, every constitution was overthrown. Kwame Nkrumah, the first republic, was overthrown. Came Dr. Buzia, it was overthrown by the army. Dr. Hilal Iman, it was overthrown. Then the soldiers ruled for almost 10, how many years? I think from a long time anyway. Then it changed. Ghana moved to constitutional rule. And so when they were drafting this constitution, they decided that why is it that every time the constitution comes, it's overthrown and we start all over again. Let us establish an independent commission that will talk to the people, educate them, all the people, that the contents of the constitution, about the contents of the 1992 constitution, to let them know their duties, their civic responsibilities as good citizens, and to protect the constitution so that it doesn't get overthrown so rapidly again. So it was established. And I think at the beginning, I wasn't here, but they did a good job. And the reason why I'm saying that is, right now, if you think of, say, the Russia, before the elections, if you ask anybody in the street who will win the election, they will tell you, but it's Putin, because Medvedev is Putin's man, so they are going to win. But this country was really educated at the grassroots to believe in the power of the thumb. They were told after 20 years or 10, 15 years of military rule, that so many years, now go and vote, and your vote will be counted, and you will elect the government you want. So that was done in 1992, and the NDC won. The NDC, people say, was actually the PNDC, which metamorphosis into the National Democratic Congress. So they won 1992, they won 1996. 2000, a different political party won. Yes. And all this time, we have been educating people. And if you look at the voting pattern, every year, more people come out to vote. In fact, 2004, 84% of the registered voted. And the way that they are struggling to register now, I have a strong feeling, come 7th December, probably we might get around 90% going out to vote.
How would you describe the relationship of this commission to the government? I'm specifically interested in the ways that the commission has tried to build its independence. And there can be many different ways to build this kind of independence. So what steps were taken to create an independent
If you look at the act that established us, I think we are one of the luckiest commissions because it states categorically, and I'll give you a copy when I finish. It says, members of this commission should have independence. They should not be under any government thumb. It's stated in the conditions of service. And because of that, we make sure that we jealously guide our independence. And so far, since I've been here, since 2004, I can say that no government has said a thing to us. You know, we have been very independent.
Who has the power to make appointments or dismiss people on the commission?
It's also in the law. The members of the commission shall be appointed by the president, acting on the advice of the Council of State. Members of the commission shall be persons who are qualified to be elected as members of parliament. Members of the commission shall be persons who do not hold office in any political party. So, as you see, we are appointed by the president, acting on the advice of the Council of State. And these things, not being a member of a party, takes us away from the political arena. So we are actually independent of the government, as independent as can be, considering that we get our pay from the Consolidated Fund.
That was exactly my next question. Where does the budget authority rest, and does the executive branch have the authority to alter or withhold allocations to the commission?
We make our budget and present it to the Ministry of Finance, and we are treated like any state institution. Our payment, our salaries are paid by the government. We are giving money to do the work.
And are funds available?
And sometimes we get development partners who help us with equipment, like my computer was given to us by the UNDP. We get, logistics from the UNDP. And sometimes we collaborate a lot. We say Danida with USAID gave us some money for doing civic education club for school children. They bought us some constitutions. So that is how we have been managing.
Are funds available to you on a timely basis?
Never. In fact, that is our challenge. Considering that the constitution and the law says we should establish offices in every district. Now, we have got 147 districts now. The amount of money given to us, and we have staff, at least we should have about 8 persons in each district. The amount of money given to us to do the job, when we share it fairly among the districts, sometimes in a month, they get about £50 to do civic education, which is woefully inadequate.
What is the source of the trouble, in your opinion?
The source of the trouble is there's not enough money in the government chest to begin with. The second is that I don't think civic education is valued as much as I think is important and should be valued. I think they think we are there and that's it. But I know that it's a very important institution.
So how do you overcome the obstacle of low cash flow?
We plead a lot with the government, and we always make them know how important it is. And last week we were in the news a lot because we carried out an opinion poll, and I think there was a question about who won the elections, which everybody was jumping up and down. In fact, even though it's a sort of bad publicity for us, but it has made people sit up and think about the commission and what we are doing, because at first it was business as usual, and nobody really wanted to know. What, for example, there have been a staff vacancy on the commission since I've been here, which is 5 years, and I hear it was vacant since 1998. Nobody has bothered to fill that vacancy. And now, in fact, all the commissioners are due to go to retirement, and nobody has appointed anybody to it. You know, that is, it looks like because we are independent and because the government wants to leave us alone without interfering, nothing gets done which should be done officially. And to me, that is not right. I think there should be a body or a desk at the castle, the seat of power, that constantly monitor the independent institutions, because after all, it is the president, on the advice of the Council of State, that appointed us. The president, on the advice of the Council of State, can also disappoint us. So I don't see why nobody bothers to look. I mean, you just appoint them and say they are independent institutions, and you let them be. I think in some aspects, since the money we are spending is the public funds, I think there should be more close monitoring than it is done at the moment.
This is continuing the interview with Mrs. Agustina Acumeni at the National Commission for Civic Education. We were just discussing the responsibilities for voter and civic education and how those responsibilities are shared.
Yes. If you look at the functions that are allocated to us, it seems we are the people who the Constitution mandated to do civic education in the country. So all the NGOs should really be working closely with us. In fact, we should set the standard for civic education, and we have been working on that, because you do not want to open the floodgates so that people will come and do any kind of civic education, which is maybe alien to our culture or our tradition. There are some issues that may be alien to our culture. For example, we have ways that we approach our traditional chiefs. So this, as other civil societies may come and get funding from, say, European Community, and just go to the chiefs without paying the normal homage, which we are supposed, and that can easily turn them off and not let the people listen. But in spite of our political system, our traditional authorities still have a great deal of influence on the citizens. And I must say, even they wield more respect than the members of parliament in the area. Because if the chief of the traditional chief beats a gongon and call all the community to come together, they will assemble without question. But if the member of parliament in the area make announcement or even pay for a gongon to be beaten, there will be a division in the community that will assemble, because they will say, oh, this party MP, then it becomes party allegiance. Whereas the constitution forbids the chiefs, just like us, from indulging in politics. If a chief calls, both all the people from the various parties will assemble. So we that is how we relate to the NGOs. And most of the the non-governmental organizations or civil societies do not have offices or staff in the district. So most of the time, they come to us and then they use our staff to do their work for them. Because we don't get the funding. When they get funding, they work with our staff. And most of them acknowledge the usefulness and the help that they get from our staff in their districts.
How do you go about crafting messages for the election? Sometimes you have messages that are instructional, telling people to go here and bring this card. Some might be motivational, that encourage people to come and vote. And others might be admonitional, telling people to not to impersonate another voter. Who's involved in the development of the messages for the election, and what considerations do they take into account?
We have a literature and materials development department, and they make leaflets. Our leaflets are mostly around peace and no violence, non-violence. Now, some of our posters, we are still developing them, but sometimes we make it graphic because of the illiterate population. They have to see in pictures. So we have a poster that was very popular, which we said, we have a cat, a dog, and a mouse sitting around a fire, relaxed. And that is how we say tolerance and peace, in spite of all the differences between a cat and a dog and a cat. they are sitting by the fire together. Then we have cartoons which we show on TV indicating that you should agree to disagree, no violence, we are all the same people. We have that. And then we also have drama in the marketplaces, in town halls, and in churches and mosques, where we graphically do drama to tell the people how to go about and have a peaceful nation. Now, on the election issue, you see, it's divided into two types of education. The Electoral Commission is in charge of the voting. So if you put it into grammar and ask this question, who is organizing the elections? It's the Electoral Commission. When are they going to, what time are they going to do the elections? It's the Electoral Commission. How are they going to do the election? It's the Electoral Commission. Are they going to use a thumbprint, a tick, or a cross? What are the ballot papers going to be? All these questions are technical questions which can be answered by the Electoral Commission. Now, when it comes to civic education, our responsibility is more psychological, to appeal to the citizens that in democracy, there should be participation. All of us should participate. The duty of a good citizen is to go and register. And when there's time to cast your vote, to go and cast it peacefully, quietly, and move away. So we answer the psychological question of why is it important for a person to go and vote at all? And why should they vote in peace?
At what point during the electoral process do you release these messages?
In fact, our work is throughout the year. Unlike Electoral Commission that have specific time, we work out throughout the year. But we intensify voter education in terms of peace building in the election year. We have been talking since September last year to party youth activists, telling them why they should not be used by politicians who want power and may incite them to violence. So that one, we do it all throughout the year. And that all the leaflets we have, we give it to them. So it's throughout the year. And then we help. We see, for example, this voters registration. There's going to be exhibition of the voters register. Most people do not think it's important at all. Even though the Electoral Commission may tell them we are releasing the books at this particular time and you should all go and check, they don't. So we have made it a big program, a good activity, that in all the districts, in all the units, in all the villages, we will go and tell them the importance of going to check that your name is on the register, because that is where the trouble starts. If they don't go and check that their name is there and recorded right, on the election day, they go to vote, and because they can't find their name, a queue starts building behind them. They refuse to leave the place, and within a short time, when there will be trouble there, as soon as too many people are there and they are arguing, I registered, and why is my name there, then the beginning of trouble. But if everybody listens to it, and then they go and check their names and make sure that they are there correct. It takes about 1 minute for each person. They just go, you take their name, they take their ballot papers, go and do it, and end of story. So we value the exhibition. Going to check your name on the exhibition register as very, very important.
How effective do you think this type of voter education is? And how would you measure that effectiveness?
We constantly do monitoring and evaluation. We've got a research department. So whatever we do, after we have done it, then they go out to the field and do monitoring and evaluation.
Have you found that there's some messages or types of media that are more influential than others?
I think the drama is more influential in the villages. because it's graphic and it's a drama, and they know drama, and they see it visually, and we show pictures, photographs, we show cinema. We got two cinema vans. So whenever we have done a program, we also show films after that, and it's very popular. It's more popular than workshops. Workshops, it's targeted towards the people with middle education and lower education, like maybe basic school education. The workshops, it's good for them. But the drama, the derbies with the chiefs and the citizens, that one is more popular. When you come to the intellectuals, like university, that one, symposia and the workshops are good.
Are there any groups of people that are particularly hard to reach with information, and what steps are taken to reach out to those groups?
The people who are more difficult to educate are the intellectuals in the capitals, the educated ones. They think they know everything, but unfortunately they don't know the nitty-gritty issues which we should. So what we do is we target groups like the military. We go to their camps and do education with them. We go to the police and do education with them, the security agencies. I wish we had money to do more of those, because any time we do it, it's quite popular among them and they are quite grateful for it. We intend to do it with the parliament, but they are always in session or they have gone to their villages and things. So it's very difficult to get these target groups.
In many countries, voter and civic education is conducted entirely by the election commission itself. Mm-hmm. And Ghana has a separate commission for yes. civic education. What do you think are the advantages or disadvantages of that kind of structure?
I think that there's a bit of a disadvantage, because we have to synchronize our activities, and we should be able to be on the same platform doing things. It happens in the districts, but in the capitals and in the head office, it doesn't happen often. I mean, for example, this voter registration, we were not involved a lot, but I think the groundwork we have done worked, because we still got a lot of people trooping out to vote, and that is our mandate, to educate people to know their civic responsibilities and to act on them. So, I mean, from what we saw, people are aware of their civic rights and their responsibility to register possibly for voting. But Electoral Commission opened a few polling stations. Now, how we would have done it different is how, if we were working together, this information about, there are over 5,000 polling stations, or 2,000 and something, they didn't open all of them. Now, what we would have done was to make sure that we display enough information in the media at the particular polling stations, put a poster there indicating that this polling station has not been opened. Your nearest polling station where you can go is this time or that time, which we didn't do, and it confused a lot of the people going to register. So this is some of the little issues. And also, when we were going for money for voter education, the ministry thought, why should we give you money when we are also giving voter education to Electoral Commission? There was that conflict there, and we had to go back and explain to them that ours is the psychological bit of education, and also, you know, talking to the people in the language they understand, because all the districts we employ staff who speak the dialect, so our education is in the language which they understand. And when we finish whatever education we are doing, we always have open forum for them to ask questions, so that we can ascertain whether what we taught them has really gone down well.
Are there any kinds of mechanisms in place to help facilitate coordination of messages or coordination of activities with the Election Commission?
Oh, I mean, it is only on the relationship basis. I'm very close with my colleagues there, and I'm close with some of the staff. Some of my staff are also close. So on a casual basis, they go and get materials which we need. But I think it should be more formalized, and we should be meeting more than we do at the moment.
If I asked you for advice about how to best convey information or messages, specifically I'm interested in an election, in a country similar to Ghana, what advice would you give?
I will advise you that if it depends, you have to first of all assess the literacy rate of the country, the people you are going to talk to. If they are not very educated, then use the drama and pictorial and cinemas to do your education. If they are literate, like say United Kingdom, do leafleting, because that is what is done there. In the election, nobody goes educating anybody. And the education comes in the form of leaflets. They have a good address system. They give all the, I used to work with elections in Britain. I was a presiding officer at each elections they had. So I'm well versed in election duties and registration and that sort of thing. And I know that, for example, the parties are very active in their recruitment drive. My three children, when we went there, they were very young, under 10. But as soon as the first one turned 16, we got a drop and her name addressed like a young lady, Miss Akumeni, thank you. Your birthday is today and you are 16. And we are the Liberal Democrat Party. We are inviting you to join us. Then Labour came, then the Conservatives came. So right from the beginning, the young person who has just finished a basic education is introduced to the parties and they read to make their choice. You know, whereas here, we don't have address system. We don't know the birthday of anybody, most people, so that won't work here. So it depends on the audience you are targeting.
How do you recruit your staff members at the district and local levels, and how much staff do you have, and do you feel that it's adequate?
We recruit by advertising in the local papers and the national papers, and then we do interviews for the senior officers. And the regional level, we allow the regions to interview for typists and drivers. Now, at the moment, the staff strength is approximately 1,600 members of staff, and is distributed about our establishment. A staff establishment should be 11 members of staff in each district. So that is how we are short of staff at the moment, because the new councils that came, we have not had enough money to open the offices, so they are supervised from the closest districts.
How are your staff members trained?
As soon as they come in, we have induction for them at the regional level, and we tell them about the commission, and occasionally we call them together at the regions, and the members with them interact, and then we also have formal training for them. Whenever we are embarking on an activity, a major program, we call the district's trainers courses, and we train them on what we are going to do the training about, and they go back and train their staff and start work.
How adequate do you think this type of training is?
I think it's good enough, but we should be able to do more, because sometimes when we haven't contacted them for a long time, they feel that they are being neglected and what is happening. So at least if we can have them maybe 4 times a year to this sort of thing, it will be good.
And do you have any ways of evaluating the performance of your staff?
Oh yes, we do evaluation, performance monitoring, performance appraisal, whatever. We do it from the basic to up. So where we do that.
How do you protect staff members from threats or any kind of intimidation at the local level?
They don't get that often. They don't get threatened because our work is quite, it's advisory. We can't do any much. We just appeal to you to do things. But it's not. But I think if there were valid threats, we will protect them.
What advice do you have about the timing or the sequencing of different election and voter and civic education? Do you have advice about how it should be timed or how it should be sequenced?
Ours is all the time. It's a civic education. It's not a periodic affair. It is constant. So how we keep it up is that, like the school children, we want to catch them young. So we have established civic education clubs in the second cycle institutions where we make sure that we teach them the contents of the Constitution. And we have designed a game, which we call the Constitution game. A copy is over there. And they play it. It's like a Monopoly, where they learn the Constitution while they are still enjoying a game. So the children one, we do it as they are growing up until they become adults. And we try to establish it in workplaces, but sometimes it's not sustainable.
We are continuing the interview with Mrs. Agustina Acumene at the National Commission for Civic Education. What other methods do you use to reach out to certain marginalized populations, maybe women or the disabled?
We have special program with women. These programs were actually sponsored by UNDP. And we did it just before the district assembly elections in the year 2006, because we realized that when the African peer mechanism, they came and did their peer review in Ghana, the report stated categorically that women were woefully underrepresented in the decision making. So we should try to encourage more people to get into the district assembly and then train them to be able eventually to get to parliament and represent women. So with these specific activities targeted to encouraging women, and we did it in collaboration with the Ministry for Women Affairs, Women and Children's Affairs. And when we monitored later and got the figures, there was a slight increase in the attempts that women made to get to the district assemblies. So we are building up. It's very, very gradual, but we are working on it.
You have mentioned that you partner often with international donors. Our program is aiming to help citizens and policymakers build relationships with international organizations and donors, but sometimes those relationships affect the ability of people like you to do their jobs well, and sometimes foreign assistance creates its own set of problems. And so I want to ask you, are there two or three mistakes that you commonly observe in the way that donors make with respect to relationships in the host country?
Yes, there are some things which I think, you know, for example, when we get the donor support, they sometimes come with programs which we should do, and they have time on it. Now, because we are on the ground, we always know that this is the way to time sectoring activities. For example, we know that when it's farming season, it's no use going to the villages to do education there, because the people will go to their farms and you won't get the audience you want. But when it's a period when there's nothing going, then they are more bound to listen to you. But because most of the donors, they come with their funds and it's time bound, you are expected to fit your education in that slot. And it sometimes doesn't work the way we really want it to work. So I think if they are more, they involve us more in the planning of these activities and not be so specific on their timing, it will be more effective.
In your line of work, is there an aspect of donor policy or management that you think works better now than it used to?
Sometimes you don't understand each other very well. Sometimes they act.
We were returning with the interview with Mrs. Akumeni at the National Commission for Civic Education. And she was just outlining the aspects of donor policy that may work better now than it used to.
Yes, I think now too there's this method of channeling the monies through the ministry. And sometimes we are deeply involved in governance, but because there are so many different governance institutions, you may hear that it's really civic education they want, but it never gets to us. It ends up with other institutions, and we don't come in at all. So again, I think sometimes, you know, it should be worked out in such a way that they deal with us, and it's agreed, probably we sign a memo of understanding, then it goes through to us. That would be a much better arrangement.
If you could offer others here or in other countries some advice about how to effectively work with international donors, what recommendations would you give?
I would say that the donor countries are very helpful, the development of democracies. In fact, they have helped so much that I think Ghana's democracy will not have grown to where it is. And as much as possible, we should try to work towards their terms, because they also are answerable to the taxpayers in their various countries. And it is the taxpayers' money which they are using to help. So strictly speaking, we should not be so over-reliable in donations. We should try to sustain whatever they have started with us as they leave. For example, the International Labour Organization gave us $55,000 last year to do civic education on the worst forms of child labour, because there are horrible places like last week we were in Volta region in a mining community. They mine for a certain clay, a white clay, and because the clay is underground, children have to dig holes and then walk into little tunnels to dig this clay. Sometimes it caves in and kills them. So ILO did a research with us and they gave this money to do the education, and we did it. And what I'm saying is the ILO money will run out very soon. And it's our duty to try as much as possible to sustain the campaign until child labor is eliminated completely.
Are there any other countries whose experiences you have found particularly instructive in your work here? And what would you say you found useful about those?
Because my background is in local government in Britain, I mean, I find their system very, very good, like the decentralization of the local government system. It works wonderfully in Britain. And when I heard that there was decentralization in this country, I was very happy, because I thought it would be like London, where there were different boroughs set up their own things, and they get subsistence from the central government on equal basis, and the districts can do a lot of things without resorting to the central government. I mean, I can't see anybody rising up to plan a coup d'etat in a developed country like London, because even if you go and bomb the whole of parliament, the districts, the local government will work, and it will not affect the districts. Whereas here, every single thing we run to the central government. the districts are not being able to survive on their own, and they every time they look up to government, and of course government can't do everything for the districts, and there's a need for self-help and then educate the citizens to be able to do things for themselves because they are capable. We have been doing something we call social auditing, where we told them to get involved in the development of their districts and monitor to see if monies coming in are spent equitably and legally without people preferring the money for themselves. And the chiefs and the people were quite happy to know that it was their duty to look after the government money sent to the district because it also belonged to them.
What do you think will be the biggest challenges to arise in this election environment in Ghana, and what do you think will be the biggest opportunities for this election?
The biggest challenges will be ensuring that the voting goes smoothly and we don't have any violence, because the fear now is people are so much aware of what happened in Kenya, what happened in Zimbabwe, and because of that they are all on tenterhooks. But I know that because of the education we have done and the way that Ghanaians are aware of their responsibilities and their love for peace, these elections will go smoothly. And the joy is that we would have clocked another social success in our democratic dispensation.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, dear.